Morning, Your Honor. This is a contract case. This deals with an insurance contract. My client, the widow, Laura Steele's husband, William Steele, through his employment, voluntarily participated in an accidental death and disbursement case. He paid the premium himself 100%. He elected what level he wanted. He picked $500,000 in this case. He unfortunately died in an auto accident. The insurance company says they don't have to pay because he was in commission of a felony. That's in their contract. What the appellees want you to do and what the district court already did was rewrite the contract for them.
Well, let me just ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
Is the plan, the company involved in the case at all, or is it just you and the insurance company?
Yes, sir. It's just us and the insurance company.
The company or the plan didn't review the insurance company's determination or
not that we're aware of, sir. And on top of that, sir, they state in their brief that they had full control over the policy and could amend it. And in the SPD, it says very specifically that CSX, who is the employer, cannot amend orally or in writing whatsoever the insurance plan.
I was just curious whether the plan or the company had been involved in the litigation at all or whether it's just you and the insurance company.
Insurance company, Your Honor.
And let me ask you a related question. So there is diversity jurisdiction. If this is just a pure state law case and no ERISA or anything, how would that affect the substantive determination whether the felony exemption applies? Wouldn't it be the same?
It would be the same as far as the felony question, Your Honor, but it would not be the same as far as count two, which was dismissed, which is vexatious refusal. If it was not within ERISA, we would have that count under the state law. Under ERISA, we don't have that count. And in this particular case, we think it's important to maintain count two. That's the difference, count two.
Right, but if we decided that whether just treating as an ordinary insurance dispute or under ERISA, if we decided that the felony exemption was applicable, then your count two would fall out, wouldn't it?
Yes, sir.
Vexatious.
Yes, sir.
It's dependent on one.
Yes, sir. Whether or not that Mr. Steele was in the commission of a felony at the time of his death.
And let me ask you just one more question.
Yes, sir.
On the substance of the felony thing. I was puzzled. There's reference to a felony enhancement. What exactly is that?
Your Honor, I practice a lot of this in Illinois. What it is when you have your third DUI in the state of Illinois by statute, the state's attorney and no one else, not a court, not an assistant, only the state's attorney is entrusted in the state of Illinois with the ability, once you're convicted of a third misdemeanor DUI, it can be enhanced at sentencing to a felony by presenting the two previous DUIs. There's the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin I get, and I was reading it over the weekend. I found a case in there that's just been reported, and I tried to get a cite for this court, and under Fast Case, and there's no cite yet, but the Fifth Division on November 22nd, the day before Thanksgiving this year, issued a case in the People of the State of Illinois versus Daniel Robinson. And in that case, it was a bench trial for the third DUI. The judge had thought the elements of the crime were you had to show the first two DUIs. He was struck down and reversed by the appellate court, saying that the first two DUIs have nothing to do with the act itself. That's to the sentencing stage, the enhancement. And even in a bench trial, they reversed the judge on that.
So you're saying the conviction for the third DUI is a misdemeanor conviction. Now, if the DA decides to request the enhancement and he proves that there were two previous DUI convictions, is that then binding on the judge, or does the judge have discretion?
Well, the judge always has discretion, but it's my experience in about 27, 28 years of doing this that the judge follows what the state's attorney wants to do. Your Honor, what it comes down here is this court said last February in Trudot that the nature of the act is what counts, not the penalty. In February of 2006, this court issued that decision right on point, saying it's the act, it's not the penalty. So if the penalty is the enhancement for the felony, but the act is a misdemeanor, then what the insurance company wants this court to do, as the district court did, is rewrite the policy. The insurance company wrote the policy. Most policies I'm familiar with, and most of the case law, in fact, one of the cases cited by the appellee, the sister's case, involved a third DUI. But that insurance policy covered an exclusion, any illegal acts. That's up to the insurance company writing their own contract. They want this court to either skirt the idea of felony, to interpret very liberally, or rewrite the contract completely. It says commission of a felony. Under Illinois law, there's no way a person can commit a felony in a DUI. If it's the 3rd, the 10th, the 20th, whatever it is, if the state's attorney has abilities, starting with the 3rd, to enhance it for penalties, but that's not the act itself.
Could he have been prosecuted for reckless endangerment or reckless injury or mayhem or something of that sort?
Your Honor, he could have been prosecuted for anything the state's attorney feels they could prove.
I mean, there is an offense. I just happen to have a recent case involving Indiana reckless endangerment statute. It said a person recklessly created a serious danger of bodily injury. That's a felony under Indiana law. Isn't there a comparable felony in Illinois, or has that not been discussed at all?
That has not been discussed, Your Honor, and I would say it has no relevant place here. The position of the denial letter from the insurance company is he was commissioned a felony because he was on his 3rd DUI. They focused the issue what it was, and that was it. And it's our position that 3rd DUI, 5th, 10th, whatever it is, in Illinois can never the act be anything more than a misdemeanor under the statute of Illinois. And when you look at the 3 courts that we cited, in the Brom case, there was a 3rd DUI he was being tried for. It was a misdemeanor. In the DePace case, they say that it's a misdemeanor to have the DUI. It's an enhancement for the felony, but it's not the act. And in the last case, the Reynolds case, which I will get a cite for this court when the cite is out, which came in, like I said, the day before Thanksgiving, said that the first 2 DUIs aren't even elements of the crime for the 3rd DUI because it's not a question, is this your 3rd DUI? You're tried on the facts. Is this a DUI or not? Are you convicted of a DUI? And if you are, it's a misdemeanor.
Does it matter? This is more than just a 3rd DUI. This guy was driving on a suspended license at extreme speed. He was more than three times over the limit of being inebriated. He struck another vehicle and injured a person in that vehicle, and unfortunately he killed himself. But this isn't just a 3rd DUI, is it?
Yes, sir, it is. That's the way the insurance company's taken the position on their denial letter. They chose what they wanted to deny it on. In the affidavit we have from the state's attorney, it would be, he would see as a DUI misdemeanor. That's a part of the appendix we have there.
But look at the arbitrary and capricious determination under ERISA.
Yes, sir.
I know that's the somewhat contention, but this is what the administrator determined, and that's kind of what we're reviewing here, whether that was just a out of the park or completely arbitrary or capricious determination, as opposed to what maybe or maybe not the prosecutor would have done.
But it's not the prosecutor here, Your Honor. Prosecutor, that thing sticks for itself. But the law itself, the act itself. And like I said, last February, this court issued a decision right on point saying it's the act, it's not the penalty.
But that case, counsel, had policy language that excluded coverage for illegal acts.
Correct.
And that's what the school sister's case did as well.
Correct.
In this case, the exclusion turns on the nature of the punishment, whether the crime is punishable as a misdemeanor or whether it's punishable as a felony. And there is no question that Illinois law in this case makes 3rd offense DUI punishable as a felony. So the distinction that you're trying to draw is simply not in play here.
I disagree with Your Honor. The question here is the act. It's not the penalty, it's the act.
No, the policy language turns on the nature of the penalty, whether it's a felony penalty or whether it's a misdemeanor penalty. And there's no question that this act is punishable as a felony.
No, ma'am. It says commission of a felony. Commission,
right,
is the act.
But the felony,
it's not,
misdemeanor,
it's not the
distinction
sentencing.
Is all about penalty.
No, ma'am. It's the act. The commission. That's their language. It's commission of a felony. Commission,
no,
is the act.
What distinguishes a misdemeanor from a felony is the nature of the penalty.
No, ma'am. It's the statute, because there's statute. A good example, their case they cited here with the Berg, the bomb case, There's no way you're never not committing a felony when you're creating a bomb. That's a felony from the initial time of starting it.
You know, historically, the only distinction traditionally between a misdemeanor and a felony was that a misdemeanor was an offense punishable by no more than 1 year in prison, and anything above that was a felony. So,
But the statutes, Your Honor, set forth.
As Judge Sykes said, the defendant, if he had survived, he could have been punished by a prison sentence in excess of 1 year, and that would have made him a felon.
Your Honor, though, it's the commission of the act and the statute in Illinois. And this court has said before in Dawn Equipment Company, they leave the interpretation to the Illinois courts on the DUI statutes.
Okay, well,
thank you,
Mr. Walker.
Thank you.
Mr. Swofford.
Good morning, Your Honors. I represent the defendant, Life Insurance Company of North America. And as the court knows, there are two issues before the court, whether this is a ERISA plan, this CSA.
No, I really find that, your argument there, mysterious. There's no plan language involved. The plan is not a party. There's no issue about the meaning of the plan, nothing. You just have a dispute over your insurance contract. And well, how does ERISA come in here? Why should a federal court, of course, you have diversity, so it's here anyway. That's no problem. But supposing there weren't diversity, what earthly reason could there be for a federal court to have jurisdiction over a case like this?
This accident insurance policy was set up as a part of an employee benefit plan.
So what?
Well,
the company is not involved in this litigation. The plan is not involved in this litigation.
You know,
Why should the origin of the insurance company, of the insurance contract, be important? And why should your company, which is just an insurance company, be cast in the role of a plan administrator and given some special deference?
Well, virtually all ERISA plans. I mean, what you're thinking of is
I'm
sorry.
Give me a reason.
Well,
something that might appeal to common sense. Why there is a federal interest in how this insurance dispute is resolved?
Because I believe the statute, the ERISA statute, by that the federal government has an interest in benefits plans of all types established by employers.
I understand how the company said, or you said, that Mr. Steele was not an employee, was not covered by the plan, he was not eligible. I understand that would be an ERISA issue. But all we have is a suit against an insurance company claiming that the felony exemption in the insurance policy is not applicable. And I don't see what that has to do with ERISA.
Well, virtually all these determinations of whether a plaintiff is entitled to benefits are delegated to insurance companies to make the decision.
Not at all. The cases we see are cases in which a plan administrator, separate from an insurance company, has made a determination.
Well, they've usually...
There are
a number of cases that I wish I could
say.
Why?
Stop. I mean, give me a reason why. What is the federal interest? What difference would it make if Steele had purchased this insurance policy directly from you with no involvement of the company? What difference would that make?
In this particular case, it wouldn't make any difference at all.
So why don't we say that in a case in which there is no issue about the plan administration, the plan language, the company, whether the company is a conflict of interest, all that stuff, we'll just say, no, this is just an insurance dispute.
Well, I think the employers rely on a uniform body of law, like an employer like this is, which is a national company. It's going to be subject to. What you're suggesting is that
legal issues in this case are governed by Illinois law. They are not governed by federal law. There's no federal law issue.
Whether it's a felony, that's true. Right? Whether it's a felony.
That's the only issue, right? That's the only issue.
Well, commission of what the
But that's
exclusion.
Not a federal question. What constitutes commission of a felony?
It's not.
That's strictly an Illinois law issue, right?
What constitutes commission of a felony is in two parts. One, under Illinois law, what's a felony, and two, what the interpretation of the insurance policy, which could be interpreted for 50 different ways in 50 different states.
It's that interpretation, though. That
hopefully not in this case.
Well, the interpretation is done by the administrator. If it is under ERISA, the administrator's interpretation is reviewed by an arbitrary and capricious. It's not de novo. And that's why I
you know, Your Honor, I have to concede in this case that the standard review is de novo.
Okay, then in that case,
but
it's not.
In many cases, it is arbitrary and capricious.
I thought at least you were trying to make the case that this was under ERISA, not just. They pay for it themselves. But because the company encouraged everyone to participate, this was the only option as far as some outside that the company was recommending. I thought you were trying to make that case.
Well, yeah, and this is only one of four different types of insurance that were provided that are described in that booklet, and two out of the four of them at least are optional. One's a life insurance plan, which presumably was paid for by the company. Yes, I mean, I should go back, besides the policy and the common sense reasons, to the statute. And it is a benefit plan established by the employer to provide, benefits for its employees. And under the safe harbor standards.
Yeah, but you have a misunderstanding. You seem to think that if something isn't in a safe harbor, it's under ERISA. That's not what a safe harbor is. A safe harbor is designed to create safe harbor says to a person, look, if you go into this harbor, you're safe. You have no worries, right? If you're outside of the safe harbor, that doesn't mean that you're sinking in the water. It means that there's an issue. There's an issue. So in this case, although there may not be a safe harbor, I can't see how the standard of ERISA, the notion that, what the cases say, that there has to be some real involvement of the plan administrator in the insurance policy. I don't see how that.
Well, I mean, this
is a suggestion to the employees. They have their own contract. They have a contract with the insurance company bypassing the plan so that when there's a dispute between the participant, between the insured and the insurance company, it's fought out purely between those two. And no company guy looking over your shoulder, right?
Well, the policy is issued to the company directly. I mean, that is really the insured, because the benefits do flow through to the employee.
They're not really insured because they're not a party, right?
I'm sorry?
They're not a party to this case.
They're not a party, and they're usually not parties to these cases, although we've often argued they have to be unsuccessfully, that the plan has to be. But we didn't argue that in this case. Aside from your conclusion or what you said about the safe harbor and our position, we also relied on the Brundage case, which I really think our case falls within, in the sense that if the employer is promoting a benefit package like our employer did, that under the Brundage standards, it falls within ERISA. And there's some interest in a uniform body of law, and I think
okay,
that Congress...
Okay, what's the uniform body of law, right? If this... If the insurance company says, all disputes are resolved under Illinois law, then you have your uniform body of law. But if it doesn't say that, where's the uniformity?
Uniformity comes
suppose he's injured in Indiana, right?
The uniformity comes from the employees having a uniform body of rights under the ERISA statute to assert
body of
claims
rights?
Processing standards.
Pardon?
Claims processing standards, the time in which claims have to be decided, the right to an appeal the claim, the time in which an appeal has to be decided. There are penalties for violations of ERISA.
Wait.
And the plaintiff can seek damages
appeals from claims. So when he applied for, or when the widow applied for the insurance and was turned down, what is this appeal process you're talking about?
Well, I mean, there was an appeal here, and the appeal did, and the matter was reviewed again, and they were given an opportunity.
Appeal to whom?
It would appeal to another level inside the company. It was the same company.
Inside what company?
The insurance company.
Right.
But you see, there are ERISA rights governing these procedures, and there are remedies.
Do you mean the appeal right within the insurance company is prescribed in the ERISA plan?
But the case has to be decided within such and such a time, and if it isn't, the plan may be liable for damages.
But wait a second. Is that in the insurance policy or the ERISA
plan? That's in the statute.
In what statute?
In the ERISA statute or regulations, one of the two.
So are you saying that when she was turned down by the insurance adjuster and appealed within the insurance company, her appeal rights were based on ERISA? Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm saying she had to have an appeal right under ERISA, yes, and her appeal had to be decided in a timely manner under ERISA.
So you're saying ERISA prescribed the procedures for processing her claim?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, well, that's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So your time expired, Mr. Walker, but you can have another.
Are there any questions else, Your Honors?
Is Mr. Swofford correct that ERISA sets the procedures by which your claim is processed by the insurance company?
That's the way it was enforced in this case, yes, sir. We had to follow those procedures. We've tried to abide by the contract.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.